Well, good evening. I trust everybody's awake by now. Last time BTI did an event, I think it was preceded by alcohol, which leads to different results. I want to really thank everybody for coming. This is a really interesting cross-section of town to gown here, not a bunch of plant scientists and academics. It's a really great cross-section of the community. We're trying to introduce you tonight to some of the kind of work that Boyce Thompson does and link it really to everyday life. And I think that's a really exciting objective, because why does research matter? And I hope if you leave this this event understanding how research affects our daily lives and can change our daily lives through the lens of coffee, no less, we will have accomplished our goal. In addition, we hope you strike up some new friendships. I already heard about one or two in the hour before this, so you can make some more in the hour afterwards. That would be fabulous. Before thanking anybody else, I want to first thank Bridget Rigas-Garzon. Bridget is the Director of Development and Communications at Boyce Thompson. I can guarantee you we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Bridget and her incredible energy and great ideas. So I want to join me in thanking Bridget. She deserves all the credit. I want to thank the collaborators that Bridget has put together and been willing to participate in this event. Not the least of which is Gimme Coffee. I think I've sponsored Gimme Coffee pretty well over the years. The best latte in the universe. And also for being out there and letting us taste the coffees and talk about the coffees. And some of you know me, the Gimme people know me as a frequent flyer there in the shop, and sometimes with my little three-year-old there. So thank you for coming, and thank you for participating and also sponsoring this event. Thank you, Kevin, and the staff. And thanks to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. One of the speakers is from the Lab of O. So we appreciate them collaborating with us as we move sort of from the gene towards the bean. The Lab of O will have an interesting story to tell. The Dyson School for Applied Economics. Coffee is partly about money. And we thank them for joining us in this event, and also the School of Hotel Administration. We thank them for letting us use this facility and the one outside. We really appreciate that collaboration, which is a great feature of that BTI has been a welcome neighbor on the campus. In addition to Gimme, we thank Wegmans for helping to sponsor this event. Wegmans is a lot of our home away from home. My three-year-old's addicted to their macaroni and cheese, but I think more importantly, they're a big player in the community. They're a great employer, and supportive events like this is really important. So again, I want to thank Wegmans for that. Now, sometimes people say, I've heard it said, that BTI is the best kept secret in Ithaca. I've been there since 1989, so I know what BTI is. Just tell you very briefly where it came from. So BTI, Boyce Thompson Institute, was founded by William Boyce Thompson, Colonel Thompson. He actually was never in the Army. He never finished school, but he was quite successful. He was raised in the mining country of Montana, and eventually made a lot of money off mining, so he gave himself the title of Colonel. You can actually do that too. So if you didn't learn anything else tonight, you can give yourself a title like Colonel, and nobody takes it away, especially if you fund the writing of your own biography like Boyce Thompson did. But he nonetheless was a real person, and he had money, and he became involved a little bit in politics. He went over to Russia around the time of the revolution, and he saw that hungry peasants got pretty angry. And in fact, they had food riots around the time of the revolution. We saw food riots around this world not so long ago when prices spiked. And Thompson made the decision that investment in basic plant research was going to be important for food security in the future. And this is a decision he made back in the early 1900s. So the BTI was founded in 1924. And now, again, if you have the money and the title, if you have the money, you give yourself the title. If you have the money, you can decide where to build your institute. And this institute was built in Yonkers, New York, the original Boyce Thompson Institute. It's still there. The building is still there. He built it across the street from his house because he wanted to see how scientists worked. Now, we know that's not as exciting as it sounds, but he wanted to see it. He did do that for 5 years, and then he passed in the late 20s. Now, Boyce Thompson in those days was an institute where the scientists worked hands-on, but then migrated more to an academic model. And in the 1970s, it moved up to its present home here up on Tower Road. That building up there on Tower Road was built by the state of New York. It is a state of New York building, but Boyce Thompson occupies it as a not-for-profit, a 501c3 not-for-profit, dedicated to that mission of studying plants in the furtherance of the food supply of human health and the environment. And it's not that different than some of the other relationships, for example, the Labo and Cornell. So we're an affiliate of Cornell, but we're independent. So I am the boss. I don't have to answer to a dean, for example. I do have to answer to my board, and I thank my board for being here tonight, some of the members. Okay. Now, BTI is going to be 90 years old next year, so it's a great time to take stock of where plant science is going and where the world is going, and we at BTI are very excited about how plant science research holds the key to solving some of our greatest challenges in the world and in the environment, in our food supply, and in health. And of course, tonight we're looking through the lens of coffee, so it gives you a kind of a vertical slice of research to the community. And if you think about that more broadly, that's kind of the mission of Boyce Thompson, to be on that research end and yet to have an impact around the world in real life. So more to focus on the coffee event itself. My notes here say that we take our cup of coffee for granted. I think that was actually true when I moved to Ithaca. There was one French restaurant down on 3rd Street in the plaza, and that was the only place that had an espresso machine. Now there's one on every corner, but the best ones are a gimme, of course. So coffee is actually important to us. But what you're going to learn tonight is how what you drink in your coffee cup is partly its consumer choice. It affects what producers will produce. It affects the quality of life in those countries. It affects the quality of life for animals. So it's really interesting. When you drink your next cup of coffee, you might think about it a little differently than you thought about it in the taste that you had just before this event. At least that's our hope. Now there's two kinds of coffee production. There's big scale, just kind of like agriculture of any kind. There's big scale intensive coffee farming, which uses a lot of fertilizers and sprays. Only cotton uses more, and cotton uses a lot. And then there's artisanal coffee production with, you know, shade grown coffee and things like that. So you're going to hear about some of the impacts of using different methods of producing coffee on the people and on the environment. So there's another issue that we want to address tonight in the coffee world, and this is a fungus called Arroyo. So coffee rust is threatening coffee production. So part of what's driving BTI's research end of this, the determination of the genome sequence of coffee, is trying to combat this kind of a threat to the coffee crop. So what is the implications of the threat for coffee plants? What is the threat for the families who produce the coffee? What is the threat for the wildlife that uses the coffee plantations for life and so on? So again, we're going to take you on a trip. And then each speaker, by the way, only has 5 minutes. So I have the unfortunate duty of enforcing that little regulation. I get more, right, Bridget? Interestingly enough, our work on coffee here at BTI is not the only commodity we've worked on. More recently, we had published on genomes of things like tomato, of kiwi fruit, which is going to be featured in Women's Day magazine, believe it or not, the cucumber, and other plants. So we're starting to decode as a scientific community, not just the human genome, but the genetic makeup of plants and other organisms. And it's really giving us unparalleled opportunities to use our knowledge of biology, again, to touch our daily lives. So I guess a great way of framing what we're trying to do at BTI is what we call actionable science. So science that has a purpose. Not every experiment works. Not every result leads to a big sea change in the world. But if you never do the science, you'll never get the action, and you won't enrich people through the training and mentoring that goes on in scientific operations. So think about it while you listen. At the end, we'll take questions. We'll have a discussion. If you have a really roasting, burning, dark roasted question that you have to pop to a person after they finish their remarks, please go ahead. We can be at least that informal. But in general, I think we'll keep the questions to the end. So on to the speaker. So our first speaker is Colleen Anunu, and you'll see their bios up here, so I don't need to read them for you. But listen, director of coffee at Gimme Coffee is a very, very important position. We all appreciate your dedication to your job and the many other things you do in your life. So Colleen, I'll turn the podium over to you.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Colleen, as you've heard, and so I'm here to talk a little bit about what specialty coffee is, kind of the current issues that is facing the coffee industry, and why we need a lot more research into the development of varieties and technology for smallholder producers. So to start it off, let me just tell you that for a multi-billion dollar industry, coffee research is about less than 1% of that revenue. So comparatively to other commodities and other economies, this is very low, especially for the second most globally traded product in the world after oil. So keep that in mind as we go through. So this is the coffee taster's flavor wheel. You might have seen that out in the foyer there, but this is kind of what we use to describe the different acidities, the perceivable acidities, and the flavors and the aromas that you can find in a specialty coffee. So this is pretty crucial to our definition of what a specialty coffee is. This is the form that we use for identifying a specialty coffee. You see we start with fragrance, aroma, flavor, aftertaste, acidity, which is not a pH, but it's what we consider a perceivable acidity. That could be malic acid, citric acid, phosphoric acid. All of this is present and natural in the coffee itself as the seed of a cherry. So moving on to body, balance, and then we have these three other boxes up there, which we call uniformity, clean cup, and sweetness. And this part of the form is what we call the objective. And so if you are getting a 10-point score in these three boxes, you are well on your way to becoming a specialty coffee. This means that you have no agricultural defects, which we consider primary defects, and we have no secondary defects, which is like processing, so after you've harvested the coffee and all of the transport and processing. So with that in mind, if you're a coffee producer that is producing a coffee that has zero agricultural defect, zero secondary defect, then you're well on your way to becoming a specialty coffee. So what this tells us is that if you get an 80 score or above in a 100-point scale, you are producing a specialty coffee. And that has its own sort of pricing mechanism built into it, or your price discovery mechanism that sometimes is tied to the coffee market, as I'll show you down the line, and sometimes is not, which is the case with many of our coffees. So another thing to know about the cupping form is for specialty coffee is that right now, currently, it's only for 100% Arabica lots. Arabica is one commercially available species of coffee. The other commercially available species of coffee is called Robusta. And if you look at the form now, you'll see that we have the box for sweetness, whereas for the Robusta fine coffee cupping form, there's no box for sweetness. And that's because there's hardly any sweetness in Robusta coffee. You don't get the same amount of acidities. You have less than half the amount of sucrose available in the cherry itself. These Robusta coffees are generally grown at very low altitudes. The ideal altitude for Arabica coffee is between 900 and 2200 meters above sea level. So with that in mind, and the cellular respiration process of a higher altitude coffee contributes to the amount of available sugars and the amount of acidity that you can find in a coffee. For a Robusta, being at a lower grown altitude, as well as having high amounts of chlorogenic acid, low amounts of sucrose, you then work on a different scale, which still has flavor and fragrance, but it's more towards the bitter end. So Robusta has a lot more heavier, hefty notes, and it has higher amounts of salt, roughness, wood. It's characterized a lot by wood and rubber, actually. So right now, they're working on developing specialty Robusta. The Robusta sequencing project has been completed. This is the major point for this event, is that the Arabica sequencing project has not been completed. For more than 65% of global production of coffee, we don't have an idea of what the chromosomes, or what the genetic sequence of Arabica is, which is mind-blowing to me. But considering that we'll learn that it is a very, very complex complex chromosome and sequence, then this will make more sense later. So with that in mind, a lot of the varieties that have been developed in national research in, systems and private breeders, it's more of a trial and error process. They're not using, they're using science, but they're not using the sequence of the genome itself because that's not available. So we see that you have a lot of these Typica and Bourbon families are what specialty coffee is really known for. So some of these varieties you tasted out there, the Pacas, you tasted some of the Catura and the Catuai. What's interesting is that these are what we call the Timor hybrid or the Timor family group, the Catimors, and then that's actually a blend of Robusta and Arabica coffee. This is really important for what's going on currently in coffee production in Latin America, because these hybrids are have less susceptibility to disease. They're more stress tolerant. They have a wider genetic background, whereas Arabica does not. It's very narrow and it doesn't adapt very well, and it is highly susceptible to disease. So this is really important because the taste is what the market wants, but the susceptibility and the intolerance really makes it a loss for many producers around the world. So the problem with the Timor, is, as you can imagine, is that it's blended with Robusta, so it doesn't taste very good, right? This is an actual cupping that I did in Kenya with one of their varieties called, I forget what it's Ruiru. I can't actually pronounce it, Ruiru 11. And so that's kind of an example of how bad it tastes. I'm a little bit of a ham, so it wasn't that bad. So that's the real important aspect of this research is how are we going to combine flavor qualities that the market wants and the market wants to pay for with the high tolerance for increasing temperatures, the land races, the climbing up the mountain, you know, all of these things that farmers are faced with. How are we going to produce high quality coffee in the future? Especially when the reality for most Latin American farmers today is this. And this is what happens when overnight coffee leaf rust blows into your farm, and within days, a blink of an eye, it turns an abundant to skeletal tree. That's a total loss. A total loss because of the market for specialty coffee wants the varieties that taste good but are highly susceptible to disease. So this is a problem for Latin America today. Juan Nicolás and I were just down in El Salvador at a conference called Let's Talk Coffee and Let's Talk Roya. And we're trying to come up with pre-competitive solutions between multilaterals and private businesses and microfinance firms and research institutions to find a way to really combat this issue on a production scale and also on the gene development scale. Currently, scientists and breeders aren't working with the market. They don't really care. There's no incentive for them to work with private businesses, in terms of like small private businesses like us. So this is the reality in Latin America these days. These are a couple of statistics that I pinched from the El Salvadorian Social and Economic Development Agency. These are the percentage of areas that you can see that are planted with varieties susceptible to rust. This is a very well-known coffee mill that is doing a huge renovation, multi-million-dollar renovation on 20 farms. They're, over the course of 10 years, they'll be investing at least 1 million new plants. This is not the reality for many coffee farmers. Smallholder coffee farmers don't have this sort of capital or, you know, this sort of human capital or resources to put into their renovation. Right now, governments are trying to work out renovation schemes through different ministries and different regions. But this is not the case. So when you have the amount of land that is planted with these varieties, that's a problem because Roya is not going to go away. Nobody knows why it happened. No one could predict that it was going to happen. and no one knows if it's going to come back this year or you know, I've just been speaking with someone that said that their farm in Guatemala is still producing a lot of fallen leaves. So this is a sad reality for the future. Coffee is a tree crop. It takes 3 years for a coffee plant from when it's planted in the field to start producing commercially. So if you see here that Honduras is actually 50% of the area is planted with varieties susceptible to leaf rust, and that's because they've had massive renovation with help from the Spanish government in the past couple of years, and a lot of varieties that have been developed, they don't taste good, but at least it's going to save their production a little bit. The export value from Central America this year is projected to drop. That's the reality. The incomes for small coffee producers and small and large expected to drop. El Salvador is almost a complete loss. And so this is especially problematic because not only are you having losses of product and value, but when you're dealing with what's happening today in the coffee market, a coffee market that's based on nothing fundamental, essentially. I mean, you have a little bit of market fundamentals built into there, but over 50% of this fluctuation is based on speculation. It has nothing to do with the oversupply, which there is, and it cannot define what specialty coffee is. It just, this isn't a price discovery mechanism that coffee needs to adhere to, in my opinion. So, you know, working together with different members of different actors, different stakeholders in the coffee industry, and trying to figure out how are we going to take specialty coffee and decommoditize it? You know, is that a reality? How can that happen? I don't know. The cost of production right now, without even combating Roya in Central America, is about, you would need to get at least $1.60 per pound. Last Friday, the market closed at $1.04. So you have people that are going to exit the market, people that have already lost their farms that aren't going to get back into coffee. I mean, we're going to deal with a severe, some severe problems in terms of, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be such a downer here, but but it's the truth. People that aren't going to be able to continue in coffee, people that are going to have a hard time in rural areas finding new jobs, not even for landholders, but for the landless poor as well. The employment in El Salvador will also fall. And these are people that, you know, more than two-thirds of their annual income is spent on food. So we have a lot of help from the World Food Program in developing solutions for these areas in Latin America right now. So, you know, with that in mind, and this is the current state of Latin America, and it could be the current state of anywhere else in the world. We have white stem borer issues in India. We have nematode issues. There's ojo de gallo in Latin America. There's Roya, which is we have the unadaptability of the Arabica plant in general, the species. So this is why we need to come together and have a pre-competitive solution for foster some serious investment into coffee research in the future. So that's the future of coffee right there.
Okay, thank you. I always thought coffee was dark and light until I saw that tasting form. So wow, you guys work hard. Our next speaker is Professor Catherine Latour. This is going to be, based on my notes, is going to be a little more upbeat. So the take-home message is that coffee is the new wine. So that's good, I think. It means subtle, got aromas, we can appreciate it. And I'm really eager to hear what you have to say about how we can improve our coffee experience. So Professor Latour.
Yes, it's going to be a little bit more positive. that we can actually inform and teach people to appreciate the wine so they're willing to pay more, and in the end that will help the producers out. So coffee is the new wine. And there's my research is in the area of consumer learning and how to get people to extract more meaning from their experiences so they remember them better later. And I've been doing that in the context of wine, but there's a lot of similarities between wine and coffee. Artisanal products like wine and coffee have the risk of becoming a commodity, which means like the yellowtails enter the market and everyone is just buying cheap wine, you know, buying the cheap coffee when McDonald's enters the market. And that if we can get people to become less price sensitive and appreciate the product that they're consuming, which I call the aficionados, they're willing to pay more, they're willing to seek out the quality of their experiences. But the problem with a product like coffee and a product like wine, it's what we call an ambiguous product experience. It's, you have this brown water, it's hot, or you have wine that you know people don't really understand what it's about. And so learning to appreciate it is difficult. So when we see an orange juice and taste an orange juice, we say it smells like oranges. When we get wine and coffee, we start describing it in other terms like floral characteristics and citrus. And so there are different elements in both these type of product experiences that become very confusing to the customers. And in wine, and we find that people become very confused about the experiences. So within the psychology area that I come from, we define different kinds of knowledge based upon either your perceptual experience. So if you drink a lot of coffee, you drink a lot of wine, you consume a lot, and that you get perceptual knowledge that way. Or you can read about it and learn about it, and that's just general knowledge of the world. And what we find is that you can drink a lot of wine or drink a lot of coffee, and it's not a linear process. You're not going to get expertise by just through that consumption experience. You really need to engage the conceptual learning as you're doing the tasting. So which we had kind of the experience out there doing a mini cupping experience. And what we find in psychology is that sometimes language can help us and sometimes it can hurt us. And if we don't really have a lot of knowledge about a product, the words can really kind of lead us in the wrong direction. So we did a study, my husband in the back of the room, in the context of wine, with novice wine drinkers, aficionados, and then experts. And we gave them a glass of wine, and then we later asked them to describe what they had tasted and write their own notes. And then we gave them five samples of wine and to see whether or not they could identify what they had tasted earlier on. And what we found was is that only the true experts, and these were people that were sommelier trained or higher, were able to properly identify the wine that they had tasted just 15 minutes earlier. That everyone else, the words really confused them, and particularly the aficionados that really didn't have the language to be able to properly describe their experiences. So again, the problem when you ask people about, you know, what do you taste or smell in the coffee? Donuts, you get coffee. You know, same thing in the context of wine. What does it smell like? Well, it smells like wine. And you know, how do we get a little bit more depth into that experience? So one way in the wine world is the wine aroma wheel, which is right here, and very similar to the coffee aroma wheel that I'll show you in the next slide. So we start giving in very kind of more general terms in the inside of the wheel, fruity and woody, and then we get more specific as you get out to the outer edges of the wheel. And Ann Noble, who is at UC Davis, developed this wheel to help. Actually, it was in a context other than learning about wine, but it was to be able to do kind of more of a cupping type analysis for the wine. And the same thing with the coffee wheel. So you notice that some of the attributes, citrus, nuts, and spice, are commonalities between describing the coffee and wine. And in, actually, David, when I was initially presenting this idea, was like, does this really help? Do these words really help? Or is it just about a lot of experts, you know, sounding smart to each other, but it's really not communicating much about anything about the wine or the coffee? And so what we did is see whether or not the words actually help, particularly the aficionados who weren't so good at identifying after they were asked to describe the wine. And so in this experiment, we gave people a California Zin, and then gave them the wine aroma wheel. We gave them an advertisement, because I'm a marketer, to see whether or not I could teach them also through verbal descriptions to better identify the wine. And what we found was that both the aroma wheel and the multisensory advertising was able to get them to identify the wine that they had tasted earlier better than no information in the control or just basic conceptual knowledge about the experience. It really was this bridging that was necessary. You needed a tool like the wine aroma wheel to make sense of what was in the glass. And I'm currently doing a project where I've interviewed master sommeliers to really understand how they get to that level of wine knowledge. And some of the ideas that have come from that is that we really need this grid, whether it's a cupping grid or in the context of the master sommelier exam when they're analyzing the wine. They do the same thing where they start with the aroma, then they go to the structural assessment on the palate, and then the final conclusion is it how good of quality is it, which is very similar to what we saw with the same cupping, that having some kind of structure to analyze the wine or analyze the coffee is a way to kind of move from the subjective, oh, I like it, to the more the objective, is this a good quality experience? And some of the things that the masters said is really that, again, that bridging and realizing that you need to bridge your own personal experiences with what's in the glass, and the same thing with coffee, making those associations. And then also recognizing that each individual is going to have a different threshold. So some people are very good at assessing the acidity. Some people are more good at assessing alcohols. And it's very similar as to other kinds of learning with athletes, that there's a different process, that it's really going through the training and being very mindful as you're doing the learning. So we did a study with in the context of coffee. So we led people through a coffee cupping experience. And then we later had them identify the coffee they had tasted earlier to see whether or not they were better at the identification. And what we found was that, yes, they were better. But more importantly, they liked the experience more, and they were more likely to spend more money for the coffee because they enjoyed the experience after doing the coffee. So there was a more of an appreciation through the learning. And some of the benefits from the producer level is that if you teach consumers about coffee, they're going to seek out the quality, so they're going to buy the better quality beans. They're going to become more loyal to the producer, so that means they become less resistant to price, so they're willing to pay more. And they become a product advocate. So in the wine world, we have lots of forums where people talk about the wines they like, they follow certain critics. The same thing can happen in the coffee world. And then they start noticing where the coffee is from, and they become advocates for a certain area, like we see with the local for movement in the food area. And they become interested in supporting the green initiatives, which kind of moves me to the next speaker.
As you can see, our next speaker is Juan Nicolas Hernandez Aguilera. And Juan Nicolas, we thank you for filling in for Miguel Gomez, who's at the FAO meeting in Rome, I think. Is that right? Here we're going to move a little bit into the communities that produce the coffee. And I think we're then going to move from the communities up into the woods. So let's go on the next part of our journey and tell us about how you're exploring this relationship.
Okay. Well, I'm going to present you some preliminary results of the research that we are doing. This is a multidisciplinary research. And we are trying basically to evaluate the welfare impact of the specialty coffee market on small growers in Colombia. Let me start providing some context. Basically, coffee is the most valuable commodity exported by developing countries, and production involves primarily smallholder farmers. The first commodity is petroleum, and the second is coffee. So, and coffee is very intensive in labor and involves the participation of many growers and their families. And the product has become increasingly differentiated, resembling the wine market. And as you mentioned, the consumers are willing to pay a higher price if they find these higher qualities. However, the point is how these growers can enter into these high value chains. So let me start with our conceptual framework. We basically see that coffee quality is our central variable, and we want to understand what are the variables that are behind the production of that coffee quality, and also the consequences of this coffee quality. So we perceive that coffee quality is the result of the combination of some natural conditions and environment, for instance, soil, weather, as well some production and post-harvest and technologies that can be very, you know, very modern, like genetics and all of these things, but also the use of simple tools. And the training of the growers and other factors involved basically are going to derive in the production of a coffee quality. Now, Once the growers achieve this coffee quality, they can participate or not in the specialty coffee market or in the commodity market. As Colin mentioned, one aspect that the market evaluates is the score of the quality. So according to this score, they can participate in each of these markets. And the participation in these markets also are going to have some impacts. We group these impacts in technological, environmental, and socioeconomic impacts. Now, these impacts are not completely independent. For instance, some technological practices can be very environmental friendly and in consequence are going to be related with environmental impact. And also, suppose that a grower who participates in the specialty coffee market has better access to credit. That is one of our socioeconomic impact variables. Well, in the midterm and long term, we are going to observe that given that this grower has better access to credit, he can improve his production techniques, he can buy better machines, better tools. So this is like the dynamic that we observe behind all of this model. So assessing impacts and basically collecting data for our general framework, we have this strategy. Basically, we went to Cauca, Colombia, and we split our sample between participants and non-participants, and we understand that participants are coffee growers that are associated with the specialty coffee market. And we expect to expand this research to other regions. So we basically split our sample, and then we start to find information about the natural conditions and the environmental impact. And for this front, basically, we are using two strategies. First, we want to understand the human ecology interactions. So in order to understand these human ecology interactions, basically, we are using GPS and taking the coordinates of the each farm. And with these coordinates, basically, we want to track what has been the evolution of land along the time with satellite images. Also, we are analyzing the coffee landscape, that is basically understand what is the kind of vegetation that we find at each farm. And according to this vegetation also, we can make some associations with habitats that probably are more convenient for some migratory bird species. So this is our strategy to get data, one of the strategies. The other strategy, we are collecting soil samples at each farm, and we went basically to the farms and we say, okay, please show me where is your more fertile and less fertile soil. And we collect these samples, and currently these samples are being analyzed for the Cornell Soil Health Institute. Now, in order to get information for the socioeconomic and production practices, our main tool is a survey. This survey covered, well, these aspects, but something that I want to highlight about this survey is that this survey actually involved the participation of the young growers who works in the cooperative that we were doing the study. And this was very important in order to advance, but also they were very happy and very glad to cooperate in our research, because right now the expectations for young growers are not the best ones. Basically, they are looking for other alternatives because, as Colin mentioned, the coffee is not probably a good option. And in countries like Colombia, this have a huge impact because there are other activities that for sure they could be involved. And finally, our coffee quality variable. Well, basically for this variable, we are working with Gimme Coffee, and we are taking coffee samples at each farm, and we are analyzing the scores of each farm. And for this part, Colleen is helping us, and she is doing the copying of this coffee sample. So as you can see, we can cover all our logical framework. And at this point, well, this is a very, we did this last summer, so we have very preliminary results. Even we are waiting for some results from the Soil Health Institute, and we also are planning to do the rest of the research next January. But at this point, we have some preliminary data. So we observe that participants of the specialty coffee market have a higher education, not only they, the growers and their families. Also, they are more likely to have better practices. For instance, they make budgets, so they know their expenses, you know. They also are more likely to consume food that is produced in their own farms. And this variable is related with food security. Also, they have better access to credit. And for me, this is very important because financial restrictions in countries like Colombia are huge. And this credit is provided not only for the government, but most importantly for private firms who actually, and probably this implies that the profile of the growers is improving. And also they are more likely to participate in social organizations, civil organizations, so they have more social cohesion compared with the non-participants. Also, we observe higher productivity for the growers who are linked to the specialty coffee market. They are more market-oriented. They use more new technologies like internet, for instance, compared with the non-participants. They also produce the coffee that is associated with higher qualities. And finally, in the environment aspect, they are more likely to use organic fertilizers and fumigation rather than chemicals compared with the people who is not linked to the specialty coffee market. And they're also more likely to use manual control, which are practices that are more environmental friendly. So this preliminary evidence suggests that there is a relation between the specialty coffee market and sustainable development. As I mentioned, this is a preliminary result. We are in the process of get more data and advancing our research. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Juan. I think you're well on your way to your PhD. And it's typical of a scientist to tell us not to quite believe him yet. It's still preliminary, but that's OK. I think it's fine. So our next speaker is Amanda Rodewald, so she's the Director of Conservation at the LabVIEW, also a professor, Natural Resources. So I guess you're new to your job at LabVIEW, so welcome aboard. And as I said, we move up into the trees.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, everyone, for coming. And it's exciting to be here. So we've been talking over the last, half hour or so, about the different ways that coffee can impact us as individuals, by the quality, the market, I guess, in terms of the cuppings and coffee as wine, and also the communities. So now we're going to look a bit more broadly and think even about how coffee affects the environment. So I think a really good place to start is with this map here. And so what you'll notice is that the yellow areas, which indicate coffee growing regions, these overlap to a really large degree with some of the hot spots of biodiversity on our planet. Those hot spots are shown in orange. So just from that alone, you know, I think we can begin to understand that the extent to which we can be good environmental stewards of coffee can have really tremendous impacts on the biodiversity of our planet. But there's good news, because coffee can be grown in a very environmentally sensitive way. Traditionally, coffee was grown as an understory crop. So you can see it here, and some other folks have shown pictures as well. And so when you look at these pictures, I mean, it looks like forest, right? It looks like forest. So it's not really a big surprise, then, that these shade coffee stands would be able to support quite a lot of biodiversity. And that is what we see. We see remarkable diversity in terms of plants, epiphytes, orchids, in terms of the amphibians, insects, and especially, of course, being from the LabVIEW, the birds, right? So these pictures are just a few of the hundreds of different tropical resident species that use shade coffee farms. And it's so cool when you're in these farms, you know, it'll be quiet and all of a sudden you'll hear little chips in the canopy and this huge group or flock of birds comes, you know, passing overhead. And oftentimes, along with these resident birds, what we see are a lot of kind of our birds, right? These migratory birds that breed up here in the summer and then they spend the winter down in Central and South America. And many of these migrants are very, very abundant in these shade coffee farms. And in fact, in some of the research that we've done, my students and I, and as well as others, has shown that if you look at these landscapes as a whole, you usually will find the greatest abundances of these neotropical migrants in the shade coffee stands. And it isn't that they're just occurring there, right? Because we always have to worry if we're just seeing certain animals somewhere. Maybe they're thriving, maybe not. But the good news is, for a lot of these migrants, they do seem to be thriving. We've done studies in Venezuela and Colombia looking at migratory birds, like this cerulean warbler shown here. And this is a bird that's a very, there's a lot of conservation attention focusing on it. It's declining tremendously. And so when we study cerulean warblers, we band them, we resite them, you know, measure how much they weigh, we find that they're actually gaining mass over the winter season. So that's really important because they need that mass in order to migrate successfully back up here to breed. And they're surviving the winter, and they're returning year after year to the same coffee farms. So it's really cool because we actually had one female that came back 5 years in a row, this little tiny bird, 5 years in a row to the same spot and the same farm. And it was, you know, so I think they become sort of attached to these coffee farms as well. But the bad news is that we're seeing a lot of conversion of coffee, of shade coffee, both to sun coffee, as we show here, but also to other types of land use like pasture. But if we focus on just coffee as a whole, I think if you look at these pictures of sun coffee, you can see it's grown like corn as a monoculture. And it only takes a quick look to notice that, you know, it's not really going to support or provide the habitat or provide as many resources to animals that need forest habitat. So there are other consequences, though, if we think more about the environment and the ways that we as humans are interacting with the environment in these communities. Because shade coffee, another advantage is that, as was mentioned earlier, many times the growers are planting other crops. So they're growing food and fiber that they can use, or even alternatives to market. So that center picture, like, don't you just wish, like, the chocolate came out, like, ready formed like that? I would so be in that business. So, you know, but this is important and actually really does affect the nutritional status of a lot of growers. We can also think about coffee, shade coffee, just in terms of keeping trees on these steep forested slopes. That's important. Right? Think about climate change, carbon offsets. You know, that is critical. And coffee, the shade coffee, those trees, also by keeping those steep slopes forested, that helps to prevent landslides. We know there's research that shows that deforestation promotes landslides, which are devastating to communities. Sometimes they're wiped right down the mountainside. But they also can impair water quality. They can, you know, reduce the soil quality due to erosion. So I think that, you know, so really in terms of the environment, the shade coffee is able to sustain biodiversity. It provides a lot of provisioning services, supporting services. If you've heard of this term ecosystem services, it's providing many more of those than alternatives to shade coffee. But I do think birds have this sort of special place in really helping us to communicate the importance of shade coffee because they're very loved. You know, they're pretty easy to see. They're sensitive to environmental change. And they're also, they can even be important in terms of the economy because they can attract ecotourists. You know, these bird farms, you know, can be really popular. So this is this picture here. It's really cool. These were, so this was at Seni Cafe, which is the science arm of the Federation of Coffee Growers. And they have these outreach programs where these kids made these little models of every bird they've seen in their coffee farm. So really touching. And from that bird frame of viewing coffee and sort of the environmental sensitivity of coffee practices, viewing it through this bird lens, we also see some of these certification standards that are out there. And so two of the ones that really have the environment and bird habitat most central are the bird-friendly coffees and also the Rainforest Alliance, if you've seen any of those. And certification is one way that we as consumers can make a choice or a statement about what's important to us, what we value, and helping to support those growers. But it's really only one part of the solution. And that's partly what our research, you know, down in Cauca is looking at as well, because it's not accessible necessarily to all farmers. But it is one way you as consumers can really make a statement. So, you know, with that, I think we only have a brief amount of time this evening, and it's a really complex issue, like anything, right? There are a lot of different trade-offs, but I hope this lets you at least start getting a sense of the different ways that coffee can impact the environment, as well as all of these other important aspects as well. So thanks.
Next speaker, or penultimate speaker, is Lucas Mueller. Lucas is an assistant professor at Boyce Thompson Institute, so of course I know Lucas very well. He's actually been at Cornell since before he came to BTI. He does something incredibly valuable. He takes incomprehensible DNA information and puts it at the service of biologists. So he's an interface person. So Lucas, give us an interface into coffee.
So I will talk about the coffee genome, and we split this coffee genome section in two talks. I'll present some general features of plant genomes and, of course, on coffee specifically. And then Susie will talk about the more the actual sequencing aspect of the sequencing project. So let's see. So first, I would like you to consider the coffee bean. And of course, we can roast the coffee bean and make a nice cup of coffee. And that's, I think, what all of us like, including me, of course. But of course, the biological function of the coffee bean is to make another coffee plant. And so, of course, you know this and you know all of this, but just let it sink in that in this coffee bean, there is the information to make an entire coffee plant. And that's just pretty amazing. The information, of course, is encoded in the genome, and the information will determine a lot about the coffee plant. It will determine where it can grow well, to what diseases it will be resistant to, and if it makes a nice coffee, for example. So let me talk a little bit about the genome project and why it's important to do it. With the genome sequence, that can serve us as a basis to understand the quality aspects of coffee. For example, by looking at different pathways that we know are involved in coffee quality. And for example, sugar content is important, caffeine content is important. And there are lots of other secondary compounds that in coffee that are really important, that have health effects, and that have effects on the taste of coffee. Another important thing, as we have heard, is that coffee is very susceptible to many diseases. And of course, we can look at the basis, the molecular basis of disease resistance when we have the genome. For example, we can look at known resistance genes, and we can look at, you know, are there similar resistance genes in the genome, and so forth. The coffee genome also will serve us as a reference to generate or to acquire genome data of other coffee plants and see all the differences with other coffee plants. And that, again, will enable us to more efficiently breed coffee. Now, one important thing I would like to mention is that sequencing the coffee genome doesn't mean that we're making a GMO plant. That's two totally different concepts. So that doesn't mean there won't be a GMO plant because of this work. That's really an important thing to remember. Now, I'd like to tell you some interesting things about plant genomes. What I've done on this slide is I have listed some of the genome sizes of different organisms. and you see that you probably know that E. coli and bacteria are very small genomes. And plants like Arabidopsis have small genomes. For example, this plant here, Arabidopsis thaliana, has one of the smallest genomes known. And it was the first genome that was sequenced because it is so small for plants. But then there are plant genomes who have huge genome sizes. So this is, for example, is wheat, is many times the size of the human genome, for example, here. So humans are only that size compared to wheat. And I know we always think we are the most advanced, the most evolved, and smartest species on the planet. We'd like to have the largest genome, but we don't. So, but it's a feature of animals that they have actually relatively similar genome sizes. So if you look at the genome of a mouse, it is actually not significantly smaller than the genome of a human. So all the mammals will be in this genome size area. Our coffee plant is kind of intermediate between Arabidopsis and human. So the question is, what makes this variation in genome size? And there are many mechanisms, but one of the mechanisms is tetraploidization. It's a complicated word, but it's actually fairly simple. What happens normally in the life cycle of a plant or any organism, diploid organism, is that they have two parents and they have two sets of each chromosome. They create gametes that have only one set of chromosomes, and these gametes reunite in fertilization to recreate the offspring. So that offspring has now again a full complement of the chromosomes. Now in tetraploidization, sometimes something goes wrong in meiosis and the gametes will have a non-reduced set of chromosomes, and what happens in the offspring is a doubling of the chromosome number. Now what's interesting about this is that this is actually a new species. It can't actually cross anymore with these species here. So this is actually a speciation event that happens in one generation. So in plants also, we can have tetraploidization between the same species. And that's called an autotetraploid. But plants are a little bit kinkier than other than animals. They can also do it between different species. That's called an allotetraploid, okay? So that's what happened in coffee. And in coffee, basically, Coffea canephora robusta, which is also referred to as robusta, which we have heard about, which is also a plant that is used for making coffee, has actually made a tetraploidization event with another coffee species called Coffea oeaginoides about a million years ago. Less than a million years ago, this happened and formed the Coffea arabica plant. So this guy has 11 chromosome pairs. This guy has 11 chromosome pairs. And now this new species has 22 chromosome pairs. So tetraploidization is actually something fairly common in plants. And it doesn't happen in animals that much. For example, potato is a tetraploid. The pasta wheat is tetraploid. Tobacco is a tetraploid. Bread wheat is even hexaploid. And for those of you who like strawberries, know that it's an octoploid, so very high ploidy level. But it's even more than that. Most plants are actually so-called ancient or paleopolyploids. And while these polyploidization events happened maybe a million years ago, there are plants that had polyploidizations maybe 70 million years ago, like maize, and that's one of the best studied examples. And they behave really like diploids, but we can still detect in the sequence the traces of the polyploidization event. And so almost all plants undergo polyploidization events. The genomes rearrange, duplications are lost, and we end up with things that look like diploids, but in reality they were tetraploids at some point. So just to finish here, I would like to introduce you to this guy here. This is the actual plant that we are sequencing. Obviously, when you want to sequence a species, you have lots of accessions to choose from. The question is, which one do you choose? And so we chose this one because it's a very special plant. There were some laboratory techniques applied to this plant to make it easier to sequence. And essentially, this plant is called a double haploid plant. And that makes it easy to sequence. In a way, the only requirement is that it is a plant that is easier to sequence because we can now determine all the differences in genetic content with other plants using this reference. So we could have chosen another reference. It wouldn't be that important anymore because we can determine all the differences quite easily now. So I guess that's where all my slides. So I'll hand over to Susie.
Uh, Susan's a postdoctoral fellow at Boyce Thompson Institute, so she works in Lucas's large informatics, bioinformatics group. So Susan, go ahead and finish the story up, and then we'll move on over to questions.
Okay, so good evening, everyone. Keyboard here, there we go. So Lucas talked a little bit about chromosome copy number and how it can vary pretty tremendously amongst plants. So just to get us all on the same page, I wanted to go over chromosomes and sort of what DNA sequencing is. So here, you've probably seen this before, chromosomes are composed of DNA amongst other things. So at the bottom we have DNA, and DNA, whenever we sequence, we're interested in something called base pairs or nucleotides. So we have A, G, C, and T, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. So you can see those at the bottom there. A pairs with T and G pairs with C. And then this pairing makes up the rungs of the double helix here. And the whole DNA complex is packaged further into proteins and wound very tightly, and that's how you end up with chromosomes. So you've probably noticed that recently there's been sort of a big influx of genomes that have been sequenced in the past couple of years. So a big reason for this is that DNA, there have been improved technologies for sequencing DNA, making it more efficient and more cost-effective. Mainly what I'll focus on here is Illumina, because that's one of the big components of the data that we've been collecting for coffee, although we are using other technologies. So the first thing you do whenever you want to sequence a genome, obviously, is to get some DNA from that organism that you're interested in. Then you fragment the DNA as part of the protocol, and then there's a number of steps that are involved in preparing the DNA so that it can be fixed onto a slide shown here. And if you look at that closely, it might be hard to tell, but there's actually 8 lanes on there. Each lane contains DNA. So you put your slide and your DNA sample into this machine, and you generate something called clusters. So basically, it takes those fragments of DNA that you want to sequence, and it generates many copies of them that are in close proximity to each other. And this is very important for the sequencing procedure. This whole process takes about 5 hours, and then you're ready to go for the actual sequencing. So it's moved into another machine, which does the actual sequencing. And simply put, what happens here are the bases are labeled with fluorescence. So each base has a different fluorescence color. So as the sequencing progresses, you can actually take images of this. And then whenever you put all those images together, you can tell by sequence which each one of those, the sequence of each one of the fragments that you started with. So that's more or less how it works, simplified. And the sequencing takes up to 2 weeks. So to give you an idea of how much data is generated from this sequencing, thus far we have about 120 billion bases of data. So this might seem strange to you. Lucas's slide showed that the coffee genome is about 1.3 billion bases. So why do we need that much data? Well, the first problem is with the type of sequencing that we use, there is a somewhat higher error rate. So if you only had one copy sequence for each region of the genome, all of those errors would be incorporated into your finished genome. So you don't want that. It's good to have more than one copy along the genome so that you can correct for these errors. The other problem is that if you, the sequencing isn't always completely uniform. So if you have 10 copies sequenced somewhere in the genome, you might have no copies sequenced in other places of the genome. So in order to get adequate coverage, so all these little pieces can go back together again, you need to have very high coverage. So this ends up being a little bit more than 90 times the size of the coffee genome. So to put this in perspective, if each one of these bases were a coffee bean, and according to my internet research, there's about 70 beans in a cup of coffee. So this would equal about 1.7 billion cups of coffee, or in other words, enough coffee to give everyone in the US 5 cups of coffee. So a lot of data. So how do we deal with this data? And this is another key point for why there have been so many genomes sequenced lately, because we now have the computational power that's able to handle this problem. So you end up with all these sequences that are about 100 base pairs long, and somehow you have to put them all back together again. So it's like a big, big puzzle where some of the pieces can go more than one place. So we need computers. And here you see the Mueller Lab server rack. at BTI. And if you look really close right here in the blue lights, that's the Boyce server. So that's the one we're actually using to assemble coffee. It has 1 terabyte of memory, so it's pretty impressive, and it's definitely up to the job. So we load the data onto the server, and then we have software that we actually use to process this information. So that can run a day or two, and then it all goes back together. Well, not really all of it, but you get longer stretches of DNA. So you're basically trying to put all the little pieces back together into something that sort of represents those original chromosomes that you started with. You never get it perfect, but it's something that you get the information you want. So another important aspect of genome assembly is to have the interface between the DNA and the computer. So here's Lucas and I in one of the offices at BTI, hard at work looking at some DNA sequence. So something that's important to keep in mind is it isn't just, the software isn't just a black box that you throw all the information into and then get something back and then run with it. You actually need to do this many times and compare the results, change parameters, try different data sets. Sometimes I'll do an assembly 10 or 15 times and then compare each one to see which one's the best. So people are important. So once you have a genome, then what? Obviously, a genome by itself isn't really that interesting. You want to find where the genes are. The genes are what give us the characteristics that we're actually interested in, like disease resistance or cup quality or all these other traits that people have been talking about in the previous talks. So again, computers come into play here. We have software that is used to predict where the genes are. So genes are just features along the DNA. So we can use the software to predict those. And once we have our genome and we have our genes predicted, then we have a good template where we can do further work. And this is probably really the interesting part of this project, is that we'll be doing additional light sequencing of varieties of coffee that have interesting traits. So again, disease resistance, cup quality, maybe a certain growth morphology. So we'll sequence those at a lighter level, and then we'll compare that to our genome, our reference genome. And from that, we can determine certain genes that might be involved in interesting traits and where these genes are in the genome. And of course, the end goal of all of this work is to use this information to help breeders breed better coffee.
There you have it, a global scene to Gene. I'll open the floor for questions for any of our panelists or researchers. I want to thank them all for their presentations, very broad. And I hope we all have a new appreciation for what's in our bellies. Anybody, questions?